So the first thing that I have to tell you is that today's show is being offered in what we call Radio for the Deaf. We have two wonderful American Sign Language interpreters who are here. They are, in fact, interpreting my words right now. That feed, the video feed of that is going on to the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page, the Colin McEnroe Show on Facebook. So if there's anybody that you know who might be interested in actually experiencing a radio show but is deaf, let that person know. I mean, they can experience it live right now, or it'll be archived there. Might not be the best subject matter to begin this experience with. We're doing a show about constipation today. I'm feeling really bad for Heidi, Mary Sue, who's sort of my American Sign Language alter ego. She's used to this stuff. Heidi, it's her first day with us, and we're hitting her with some pretty challenging material, shall we say. And this show is kind of an example of what? Art imitating life? Something like that. Just in the sense that we've been talking about, I've wanted to do this show since last year. Last year was the 500th anniversary celebration of Martin Luther. I'll explain why that's important and relevant as we go along here. But we missed that. We also missed National Constipation Month, which is December. This is in December, I'm pretty sure. So we just had a lot of trouble getting the show on the air, which, as you can see, I don't have to, you know, draw you a map, right? It's been a difficult thing to push out the show, and that's, of course, very fitting for the topic. And so what we're going to do, we're going to talk about the biology of constipation right now. Then we're going to talk about the psychology of constipation. And we are going to talk about the fact that Martin Luther... And this isn't some, you know, I mean, Martin Luther was, I guess, he was out as a constipated man. He was very open, at least with his intimates, about it, and wrote a lot about it in his letters, and it clearly affected his life. It also affected the life of Elvis Presley in terms of probably shortening it. You'll hear about that in our final segment. The final segment's a little bit gross, too. I'm just kind of warning you. even for us, it's a little gross. But I also think constipation is the thing worth talking about, and just talking about it biologically. That's where we're going to begin with Dr. Satish Rao, who is director of the Digestive Health Clinical Research Center at Augusta University in Georgia. So first of all, Dr. Satish Rao, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Colin.
So this morning, as is often the case, I had dinner the night before. I got up, I had some breakfast, and then I pooped because I'm not constipated, apparently. But if, in fact, that didn't happen, and if, in fact, it didn't happen for a few days, what would be most likely be the problem? What would cause me to not do what I regularly do in terms of digestion and elimination?
Very good question, Colin. But before I answer that, let me preempt that by telling you that constipation generally, like you've tried to do, is defined on the basis of infrequent bowel movements.
Sure.
Now, that is no longer true in gastroenterology and in medical circles. And I think it is probably a mistake that we as physicians and healthcare providers have made in the past, is trying to define constipation-related symptoms based on irregular or infrequent bowel movements.
So why is that a mistake?
Right. Because constipation includes six symptoms, of which one of them is infrequent bowel movements.
Mm-hmm.
Constipation also is hard stools. Constipation also is a feeling of incomplete evacuation after what people thought they've had a bowel movement. Constipation also is using digital maneuvers or something to facilitate a bowel movement, or feeling a sensation of blockage with bowel movement. So all of these various symptoms together is now what we define as constipation. And in order for us medically to call a patient as constipated, they must have at least two of these six symptoms.
Right. And some people, there are even cultural differences from nation to nation about how often people poop, and there are individual differences. So it would be a mistake to focus inordinately just on the frequency of evacuation.
Perfect. You've said it very well.
All right. So, and some people have a problem probably from birth, right? Some percentage of people have some underlying congenital condition which leads to constipation?
It does. there is a well-known congenital problem called Hirschsprung's disease, where developmentally there has been a problem in how the nerves connect with the nerves right close to the opening of the gut, the anus area. Because of lack of connection, there's a small segment of the colon or the rectum where there is no nerve, and therefore when stool comes, it comes up to the point, and then it is not, it does not move beyond the point because of lack of nerve connection. And that is what Hirschsprung's disease is. And that presents usually in children and in infants. And it's often picked up at that stage, and then they need a corrective surgery, after which they get better.
Another aspect of this, well, let's talk about a couple of things that people probably frequently experience. I have experienced when I travel that suddenly I'm constipated. Suddenly, I can't believe I'm confessing this, but, you know, why not? Why be ashamed of it? So suddenly 2-3 days go by and nothing. And I feel as though my internal clock is being disrupted somehow, that my body doesn't sort of know what to do. But that's my layman's guess about that. Why would that be happening?
I think you've said it very well. You have what I always call as traveler's constipation. Mm-hmm. Or occasional constipation, and that we all suffer from that. And that is because we have now tinkered with our intrinsic biorhythm. And we all have a set biorhythm. Our biorhythm involves, of course, eating and sleeping and pooping. It's all part of the biorhythm. And when we have interfered with that through travel, not eating the right thing, or postponing things that we routinely do in a timely manner, then the gut biorhythm also gets wacky, if you like. And then, you know, things don't happen the same way. And likewise, if you travel in different time zones, that also affects. For example, as you said, you woke up this morning and you had a bowel movement, whatever time, let's say 6 o'clock in the morning. And now you've gone from here to Europe, okay? Your 6 o'clock there is going to be, you know, somewhere later part of the day, or it's in the midnight. Mm-hmm. And you're sleeping or you're doing some other activity. So you've changed your biorhythm. So that in turn will affect how the body is going to take a few days to regulate itself to the local timing and to the local eating habit. And all of that will contribute to the so-called traveler's constipation, which is occasional. And that we all have. And there are some who have a very acute constipation, which is really some blockage or some major medical catastrophe that's happening. And these are the two rare but infrequent and bothersome types of constipation. The majority of the people, though, they suffer with what we call as chronic constipation, where these symptoms of constipation linger on for days and weeks and months.
Right. And so there's discomfort. Well, I want to come back to that in just a second. To what degree does stress play a role in this? Obviously, stress, first of all, makes us eat less regularly and predictably, sleep less regularly and predictably. I'm assuming stress makes us sometimes poop less regularly and predictably.
I think there may be a small role for stress. People have looked at this very, very carefully and systematically, and we've never been able to show a good correlation between stress and the beginning of constipation. What we have found more consistently is that once you're constipated, then stress really seems to aggravate the problem, or constipation itself causes so much stress that you're now mixed with constipation and stress as the problem.
So there's also a school of thought that's become more popular here in America recently that says, well, maybe one of the problems is you're just in the wrong position. Sitting down on a chair-shaped toilet maybe is the wrong way to do it. The so-called squatty potty has become more and more popular. Is there anything to that?
Absolutely, Colin. Mm-hmm. I fully subscribe to that view. I mean, there is no question that our evolution from the squatting position, that is how we were all pooping in the good old days of our ancestors, to the chair position has compromised our body's ability to poop effectively. No question. I think we have done enough research to show that as well. And I think thanks to this to the squatty potty guys who have really done a yeoman's job in doing it. By the way, I should really get the award because I have developed the Squatty Potty before these guys developed it and commercialized it. And I've been using it for 25 years in my practice, but I never had the business acumen, if you like, to go commercially with it. But nonetheless, so coming back to the question, body position has a significant effect on how we move stool, especially through the lower foot of the bowel. The angle in which we push, the pushing forces that we generate, and our ability to relax are all ideally designed for the squatting position. And if we don't use the squatting position, we will always be somewhat inefficient in our pooping ability. And that is why the Squatty Potty has been such a cool thing and really a good thing for people to use.
So some, and I think one of your terms for this sort of falls into the category of dyssynergic defecation. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but.
You have. So I think, you know, in the chronic constipation group, as I mentioned, you know, occasional, acute, and the chronic, within the chronic constipation group, there are three other overlapping subtypes. One of them is dyssynergic defecation, where the act of pooping has become incoordinated or dyssynergic. And this could be either because the patient is unable to generate enough pushing force or the wrong force, or when they're actually trying to poop, unbeknown to them, they are squeezing and shutting off the anal opening. Or they're doing both. They're pushing incorrectly and they're shutting off. So they may pass a small amount of stool, but the bulk of the stool is probably going back inside and they're totally uncoordinated. In this way, they will never be able to efficiently poop. And that is dyssynergic constipation.
You know, later in the show, we're going to hear a journalist talk about some of the reporting that is done about one particular person, Elvis Presley. But within that reporting is the notion that for some people, people who have a really very severe case of constipation, that there is considerable danger from it. Are there things that, I mean, it might be putting stress on the cardiovascular system somehow. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think the only part that I would say that may have some effect would be, you know, if one tends to strain and push aggressively, when you have the so-called increased Valsalva kind of maneuver, you can affect the breathing, you can affect the heart, and you can affect the rhythm that regulates the cardiac circulation. So you have certain very sensitive nerves in the neck. And when you're using those excessive muscles and so on, you can kind of irritate those nerves, sensitive nerves in the neck, and you can produce an arrhythmia. That can cause some damage, or you may lose consciousness, or you may trigger an arrhythmia. That is extremely, extremely, extremely rare, but yes, it can happen.
So, but it sounds like good advice is, I mean, it's sort of not like having a baby, right? You don't just push harder.
Correct. It is not a good idea to push harder. In fact, one has to learn to relax. So there is a very fine coordinated mechanism that is, you know, it is very interesting that we all learn almost serendipitously when we are young. I mean, you know, nobody literally coaches us like, you know, you learn how to write a language or how to speak a language. But here, almost serendipitously, we kind of learn this act because some of it is all inbuilt in us as almost a reflex mechanism. But in some people, this learning process has never been perfect, and therefore they suffer with constipation from childhood, and then some of them will grow into adults and they develop dyssynergic defecation and so on and so forth. So there is a little learning process, but it is almost intrinsic.
What percentage of people just need to eat more fiber? I mean, if I had constipation, that would be my first thought, but maybe that's an oversimplification.
It is, and I think, you know, the fiber story is true, but, you know, the average American takes about 7 grams of fiber a day. If so, more than 50, 60% or more of Americans should be constipated by that definition, really, and it's not necessarily true. So I think we have overblown the fiber story, but that is not to discount that part. I think we need to be eating between 20 to 30 grams of fiber a day because fiber is the main source of energy and fuel for the bacteria in the colon. And if we don't have a healthy bacteria in the colon, we are never going to produce the right kind of stool that can be emptied from the body. So every part of a body has a function. Fiber has an important role in really developing the right stool.
All right, we're going to stop there. Although, I mean, I think we've got some very good advice here from Dr. Satish Rao. Push less, squat more. He is the director of the Digestive Health Clinical Research Center at Augusta University in Georgia. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Colin. That was wonderful.
And after this break, first of all, our interpreters are holding up reasonably well over there, but we're going to challenge them even more with the story of Martin Luther, and we'll be doing a little bit of Freud, too.
I just can't go. It's causing so much frustration, this constipation.
So last year, amid all the 500th anniversary celebrations and contemplations of the legacy of Martin Luther, if you listened carefully, if you kept your ear to the ground, you might have heard some mention of the topic we've been discussing on the show today. Because, in fact, Martin Luther, and this is not a matter that's open to dispute, as you'll hear, he did suffer from terrible, terrible, painful, agonizing constipation. Joining us now is one of his biographers, Eric Metaxas. Eric Metaxas is the author of Martin Luther, the man who rediscovered God and changed the world. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I should say up front that literally for the last five centuries, Luther has not moved his bowels even one time. It's really incredible. It's a record.
Right. Even for him, that's a lot. But 6 days, yeah. You know, we know from letters and journals and stuff like that, like 6 days without pooping was something that he was very familiar with in a way that made him very unhappy. He wrote about it a lot, right?
One of the first things I wrote, my Luther book came out in October, and, you know, I was blessed with a full-page review in the New York Times, and it's done very, very well. But you are the first person to do the hard work of bringing up the subject of constipation. I'm grateful to you, Colin. I want to say that right now. And the first thing that I wrote when I was writing this book, and I'm not kidding at all, were the passages on constipation, because I found it so funny, I almost died. I thought, this is hilarious, because he eventually got over this. Everything came out in the end. When I was reading the passages from his letters that he wrote to his friend about the affliction of constipation, I thought, it's comedy gold, because you're writing about a real person, and when you think of him, you think of him as a world changer, one of the most significant influential figures literally in the history of the world. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But he was plagued, as we are all plagued, with common ailments. But the way he writes about it in typical Luther fashion, it's very, very colorful. And I just thought, I have to write this before I write the rest of the book, just to keep myself grounded.
So he wrote to a number of his friends about this, but here he's writing to Spalatin. Is that how we say that name?
Spalatin.
Spalatin.
I don't know how Americans say it, but since I'm half German, I say Spalatin. But,
he says, I tried the pills. Spalatin has gotten him some pills. I tried the pills according to the prescription. Soon I had some relief and elimination without blood or force, but the wound of the previous rupture isn't healed yet, and I even had to suffer a good deal because some flesh extruded, either due to the power of the pill or I don't know what. I'm not even sure, Eric, how to interpret that, but it sounds like his relief was so explosive.
I can interpret it.
I was afraid of that.
I have to use a four-letter word. It's ouch.
Yeah, right.
What's so funny about Luther, and part of what makes him charming and captivating, is that he is not religious in the sense when we think of religious. He combines talk of God with all seriousness with the most earthy kind of language, the kind of thing you see in Chaucer. So at times it's bawdy and really earthy, but part of what makes him fascinating theologically is that he understands that if a Christian is to really get to the core of what the Christian faith is, it's the incarnation. God becomes a human being, and a human being has a body, has to go to the bathroom. Like all of this kind of stuff that people had previously said, well, we don't talk about that. We're religious. We don't really have bodies. We don't want to have bodies. And so the first thing that I quote in my book on page 244, he's writing to his friend, the Lord has afflicted me with painful constipation. But then he gets really graphic and he says, the elimination is so hard that I am forced to press with all my strength, even to the point of perspiration. And the longer I delay, the worse it gets. And it just goes on and on and on. And I laugh because he's so human. It's what makes him, to me, so charming. And it's really why I chose to write this biography, because I said, this guy is so real and so human. He's not some ethereal theological figure. But the idea that he suffered from constipation and then later in his life, ironically, diarrhea, is to me at the very heart of who he is.
Yes, and so at one point, I can't remember whether it's that letter or a different one, he says that I am forced to carry with me a piece of the cross. And he clearly means this, that, you know, we can sort of giggle about it, but it sounds like it was just unbelievably horrible.
Well, no,
I think
right.
He sees it as a piece of the cross, as a kind of human suffering that connects him to Christ.
Yeah, we have to be clear. When we say, he calls it a relic of the cross. And what he means is that in this life, we will experience suffering. And in a weird way, our suffering is meant to remind us of the suffering of Christ. Even this kind of suffering, he says, God is using this to humble me, to make me a better person. I can't be full of myself, so to speak, because I am afflicted just as other people are afflicted. I suffer, and Christ suffered and stuff. So the fact that he's able to take this most base subject and turn it into the things of higher theology, it is why he is so charming. He's able to speak on the very highest level, but on the most simple human level. And he's actually very funny. I mean, another reason that I chose to write this book is because he's hilarious. He's very outspoken. People said to me, well, are you going to write about Calvin? Absolutely not. Calvin is not funny. He's not larger than life. Luther, it really is.
Right. Now, Calvin didn't do well in the Swiss comedy clubs at all.
And obviously he moved his bowels very effectively, and so where's the comedy there?
Right. Now, another thing, now we're sort of going to venture out a little bit onto slightly thinner ice, but we'll stay on some semi-solid ice at first. In 2004, as you well know, there was the discovery of something that might have been capital T, the capital T toilet, at least in Wartburg. There's a sense among Luther scholars, a question about is the fact that he was sitting on the toilet a lot, in cloaca, as he would say, is that a time when he's really thinking about some of this stuff and having some of these discoveries because he's got nothing else to do while he waits?
That's very funny. I literally devoted a chapter to this in the book because I think that the whole thing hinges on Luther's sense of humor. In the monastery, there was a tower. Luther's office, his study, was on the second floor of the tower, and it was a heated study, and so when he kind of was moved up in the ranks, they gave him this heated study, and he would do all his thinking and his writing there. On the first floor, on the ground floor of the tower, I should say, was the cloaca, which is the Latin word for sewer, and it means the bathroom. And so all of the monks and everything would use the cloaca tower, as they called it, to go to the bathroom. So if you had to go to the bathroom, that's where you went. So Luther played on that as a joke and said, I was in the cloaca tower, or he would say, auf on the cloaca, meaning like sitting on the toilet. So he plays with this to sort of say, yeah, maybe I was actually literally sitting on the toilet. But what he really means is that he was in this tower. And so the reason he plays on this is I think he wants people to think about what you were just saying and to kind of be ambiguous. He would, you know, he would play with stuff in this way and he would joke around and people misinterpreted him. It's a little bit like Trump. It's kind of weird. Like, you know, he says something hyperbolically for effect and then people parse it as though he was like on the witness stand and, you know, the thing, they're reading the stenographer's words. I mean, you have to understand he's half joking, but he's trying to make the larger point that at the very heart of his discovery of grace is that we are human. Jesus became a human being. And he came to earth to become one of us with all of our problems and physical ailments in order to pave the way so that we could go to heaven. But we don't go to heaven as ghosts, that we are human beings with bodies. And so it's weird that there's a lot of theology here. And again, in the book, I hope I make it clear. But it's really moving and beautiful and at the same time very entertaining.
I would even add to that the notion that, and you can even see it in some of the things that he writes, that the Holy Spirit can inform you, infuse you, inspire you, and visit you in under almost any circumstances.
Absolutely.
And taking no note of where you happen to be sitting or what you happen to be trying to do.
That's the whole point, is that God comes to us wherever we are. And it's not like, oh, I have to be in church or, oh, I have to be dressed this way or that way. God comes to us in our broken humanity. It's a huge point that he came to earth through a maiden's vagina. Let's not pretend that this happened in some way that was other than the way every one of us enters the world, through blood and pain. And this is a big theological point. And the fact that Luther was willing to write about this 500 years ago, it's pretty dramatic. And I would say it speaks to us directly today in a way that a lot of theology does not.
All right, now let's go out under the thinner ice, where I happen to know that you're not entirely happy.
There's even thinner ice?
Well, I think
when the ice is this thin, it's water, but go ahead.
You and I attended the same institution of learning in New Haven, Connecticut, where I was fortunate enough to, on one occasion, meet face-to-face Eric Erickson. Eric Erickson and young Martin Luther has a lot of very Ericksonian kind of thinking about this, that he creates an intellectual model, I guess we would say.
Well, wait a minute. People probably don't realize that in 1958, a very, very, very famous biography of Luther was written by this guy named Eric Erickson. I, in my book, take him to task. I think
right.
It is a horrible book, one of the worst books, maybe the worst biography of Luther ever written, but it was very influential.
Right, and it does bring up the constipation, but as part of this kind of intellectual model that he has, that somehow or other this cycle between retention and explosion
right.
has some connection to Luther's genius and ultimate ability to express himself in a transformative
right.
way.
So it's Freudian quackery. We should laugh at it. It's some of the most ridiculous stuff I have ever read. And the fact that the intellectual climate in the West was such that people took this ridiculous book seriously for decades, and some still do, is really sad.
Well, we're going to end there, but Eric Erickson, the book is fascinating. Martin Luther, the man who rediscovered God and changed the world. Eric Metaxas, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And so, yes, let me just say a word or two, and not in defense of Eric Erickson, but as we head into the Freudian segment here, I don't entirely agree with Eric Metaxas that there's nothing there. And I will quickly tell a story, which is I was taking a class in college from a sociologist named Kai Erickson. And one day we showed up in class and he had a surprise for us, which was that his father, Eric Erickson, was sitting on stage. And he did start to talk a lot about anality. And he talked about it very specifically in terms of Nixon. And at a certain point, I'm going to have to reword this, change one word of it. He was talking about Nixon's call to Eisenhower when Eisenhower had not fully settled on Nixon as a running mate. And Eric Erickson turned to his son and said, "What is the polite way of saying poop or get off the pot?" And his son blushed a little bit and he said, "Fish or cut bait, Dad." And he said, "That's right. The newspaper said he said fish or cut bait. But I knew what he really said because Nixon was anal." So that stayed with me. That was 1975. So we certainly do want to explore the Freudian part of this. Obviously, Freud is the springboard from which Eric Erickson and a lot of other theorists leap to their own ideas. Stefan Mariansky is with us, the education director of the Freud Museum in London. Welcome to this fairly unusual conversation. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me on the show.
So Freud obviously has five stages of development. We're really interested in the middle one. We're interested here in the third one. So tell us about that anal stage of development.
Yeah, sure. Well, before I do that, Colin, I should say, you know, that the popular psychology Freud 101 is very much this sort of idea that there are these fixed stages that we all have to pass through, the oral, the anal, the phallic, genital, and so on. It doesn't really, it enjoys a lot of prestige in the literature, but it doesn't really seem to be central to Freud's argument.
Mm-hmm.
But what is absolutely clear for Freud is that this, if we could loosely call the anal stage, is for him absolutely central to how a young child develops, and it's going to leave some kind of a mark on them that's going to stay with them as they go on into the world. I suppose a few primers for the Freudian way of looking at constipation is, first of all, to say that this anal stage, toilet training, it's a uniquely human activity. You're not really going to find an example in the animal kingdom of animals that toilet train their young. With these stages, Freud didn't necessarily think that there was a natural biological progression from one stage to the next. I think what he was more interested in is that it's really the caregiver who brings these stages into focus, so that we could sort of say that, you know, without weaning, there would be no oral stage, or that without toilet training, potty training, there would be no anal stage. So this anal stage, what it's really about is the idea that, you know, a young child has got, it's just learning to speak. It's suddenly having its toilet activities regulated. It's, you know, it can't just poop when it wants. It's got its parents around him giving messages about when's good to do it, when's not to do it. It's got a lot to, you know, depending, you know, parenting changes from culture to culture and across history. But, you know, sometimes parents will kind of schedule that the child has to do it at a certain time, sometimes not. And there are some very mixed messages the child's going to be receiving. You know, it might be at one time kind of greeted almost like a gift when a young child poos for, say, its mother. And at the same time, that might be kind of inflected with disgust. Having your nappy changed might turn out to be something that the child thinks, well, mum seems to kind of enjoy this in some way, but also be kind of disgusted by it. So there's a lot going on in this anal stage, and how we navigate that stage, according to Freud, is really going to be quite determinant in the kind of people we grow up to be.
Right, and it would be reductive to say, to reduce anybody to one drama, one trauma. We're all a symphonic orchestra of the things that mold us and change us. But to the degree that that becomes maybe one of the dominant instruments in that orchestra, obviously that notion of retention, that you, rather than just kind of letting fly whenever you're ready, that you have to learn to retain this basic bodily function in a way that no other animal does, that, you know, in and of itself, depending on how you interact with the toilet trainer, that's going to be a big issue, right?
It's going to be a big issue. And one of the reasons it's going to be a big issue is because these are very much impositions, they're rules, they're demands that are coming to a young child from without. So these are kind of complex and confusing messages. They're quite disciplinary sometimes. So quite often a child will produce the poop as a kind of gift for the parents, but quite often also they'll be expected to do it, and they'll do it against the background of kind of fear for losing their parents' love. So what we could loosely say that might set up a sort of character trait of someone who in all kinds of other more metaphorical ways might kind of be very preoccupied with giving other people what they want and kind of giving in to their demands, but at the same time perhaps holding on to a certain resentment that they want something that can't be given, you know, the sort of typical complaints that we hear about in the literature, you know, everyone wants a piece of me. Well, you know, you've got to wonder what piece that might be.
If I'm constipated, there are a dozen or so good reasons, a number of them purely medical, structural, biological. But if I'm in Freudian therapy and I mention to my therapist that I'm constipated, I assume that's a source of some interest about my possible neurosis?
First of all, well done, because I think very few people actually directly talk about their sort of bowel movements to their analysts. And as soon as they do that, quite often things really start to change for them. But I suppose it also comes with the kind of Freudian question is always going to be not only kind of about the kind of difficulties someone might have with their bowel movements, but it might also be to ask a question like, you know, in what other ways, in what other more metaphorical ways is someone constipated in their life? You were talking about Martin Luther earlier, and I just found it so interesting. I don't know much about Martin Luther, but isn't his sort of major theological complaint that the church is on everyone's backs, making unreasonable demands on them, denying them access to something sublime? You find it in not only in people's sort of pooping practices, but you also find it in things like people's preoccupation with money. And you find that quite often in sort of inflections in figures of speech. Why do we talk about making money?
Right.
Why do we make money? You mentioned also about your internal clock earlier. I mean, this is, in a sense, a kind of preoccupation with time. When is the right time to do the thing that I need to do. And so you often find people, you know, putting off doing, you know, procrastinating because they kind of want to hold onto the idea of a future triumph. And that might, you know, turn out to be related to their sort of anal stage.
Right. We're going to have to stop there, although I can't wait to come to the museum now. I also have to say that that whole notion of money and excrement obviously is sort of there in the literature of Freud and people like Norman O. Brown who followed him. And I'm always very conscious of that when I'm trying to get my dog to poop and I say, do your business now. Do your business. Anyway, thank you, Stefan Marianski, Education Director at the Freud Museum in London. Our wonderful interpreters are holding up pretty well over there, I think, but we're about to take them on a thrill ride they haven't been on yet.
I'm not even going to try to make any jokes here. I mean, they basically write themselves. Today's show is pushed out by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Colonel Tom Park. Our next show is The Nose, and the whole gang went to see Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie ever. And now, back to Colin.
We are so lucky to have back on the show Mary Roach, one of the world's leading popular science writers. Her most recent book is Grunt, which would really be a good name for a book about constipation. However, that's not what it's about. Her most recent book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And she's the author, more relevantly to us, of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, which is why we are talking to her today. Mary Roach, we're so excited to have you once again.
I am so excited to be back.
You tend to, in your books, explore the extreme ends of various questions and various dilemmas and maladies and stuff like that. In Gulp, you're kind of interested in, very specifically, the question is, at what point does constipation become life-threatening? What did you learn about that?
Exactly. And this all started with a visit to the Mütter Museum, where they have, in a glass case, beautifully lit, sort of a vitrine, I think is what they call it. This enormous distended colon. It's called a megacolon. And this is what happens when things back up fatally. And it's usually like two or three people just sort of reverently standing there staring at this gigantic. It is bigger around than my waist. It's like 28 inches around. And I heard that Elvis Presley had a megacolon. And so this is what got the ball rolling. And indeed, If you've got that condition and you're trying to deal with it by pushing really, really, really hard, you can go down the road of what is called, hideously, defecation-associated sudden death. That's when constipation turns fatal.
And apologies to anybody who just sort of can't handle all this stuff. I'm really sorry about that. But that's what this is part of what the show is all about. So we just have to face that fact. There's so many things to say about this. But maybe just to go back to the megacolon. And as you say, this is like this huge, terrifying-looking thing that's like almost the size of a person, right?
The case is 2-3 feet long and a couple feet high. I mean, it's a major highlight of that part of the Mütter Museum. It's not just like a little thing in the corner with the bracelet made of hemorrhoids and the other oddities you'll find in the Mütter Museum. It is really a showcased item. It's huge. It's huge. And you can't. And I've seen photographs of the poor man who had this. There's photographs of him, medical photographs, where he's standing there. He's a little skinny guy, but he looks like he's pregnant with triplets. It's an enormous, and it's horrible because the colon starts to push the other organs out of the way and it becomes difficult to breathe. And yeah, it's just a bad situation all around.
So this is one of these things that you don't hear about very much because it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to have it listed as the cause of death. Mary Roach, you did, I feel like in the reading, it seems as though you found that maybe more people die from aspects of this than one might ordinarily guess.
That's right. It's not just, I mean, the megacolon and Elvis Presley had this condition. There is a genetic abnormality that can cause it, but it also tends to happen people who are bedridden having to use a bedpan, and sometimes the drugs that they're on, like painkillers, can slow things down as well in the gut. So these, and a bedpan, to try to move your bowels while lying down in bed using a bedpan, it's just not a natural position. So people tend to push too hard, and it's enough of a risk that folks who are in the ICU with a heart condition will be put on a stool softener as a safety measure. So it does happen. And it's this situation where somebody's pushing really hard and it sets off this thing called the Valsalva maneuver, where you're pushing and pushing, and it causes a spike and a drop in blood pressure, and your body's trying to get things back to normal, and you can end up in an arrhythmia, a heart arrhythmia, that can be fatal, and that's what happened with Elvis.
Right. So we should say that on the one hand, you're straining, and then the other hand, when you stop straining, you relax, and there's a surge of blood when you relax, which can dislodge a clot. In your book, you say in a 1991 study found that over a three-year period, 25% of the deaths from pulmonary embolism at one Colorado hospital were defecation-associated. That ought to give a person pause.
Yeah, that's right. It could be the clot dislodging or the arrhythmia. There's two ways to die. Constipation. Yeah.
So as you investigated very specifically the case of Elvis Presley, one of the things that you found out right away was that, I think these are your words, constipation ran his life.
Yeah, I was very sad. I paid a visit to his longtime doctor, Dr. Nicopoulos, and he said that he himself has since passed away, but he said it was very sad. He had to kind of manage Elvis's appearances on stage because there were a lot of efforts made to move things along, and you never knew exactly when that would kick in, and he might be on stage and have to leave the stage. And Dr. Nick was his nickname. Dr. Nick would always have two or three boxes of Fleet's enemas on the tour bus. It was a constant and kind of horrible presence in Elvis Presley's life.
Yeah, you say that people who go to Graceland often marvel at the master bathroom, which has, you know, a TV set and stuff like that. And that's not simply a statement of opulence, right? This is, in fact,
part of it was that he spent a lot of time in there, as anybody who deals with chronic constipation does. So there was, television, there were books. It was a very lush and padded throne. It was a place he spent a fair amount of time and was appointed to reflect that.
If you think we haven't ventured far enough into a weird area so far, we're about to venture even deeper into this because obviously one's ability to move one's bowels is all probably tied up in toilet training and one's relationship with one's parents or whoever it was that finally got around to toilet training us. But with Elvis, we're into a completely different area, which is that apparently this was a problem which for him stretched back to childhood, and that his mother Gladys, well, I'll let you pick up the story, Mary Roach. What did his mother Gladys have to do?
This was something that I overheard that somebody who was at one of the, it wasn't actually the megacolon at the Mütter Museum, it was a different one, and the curator told me she overheard someone talking about Elvis having this condition, and that as a child, his mother had to manually disimpact, I believe is the medical term. And that's something that if you look back in the history, the old medical journals under impaction and disimpaction, we're not talking about just a finger, which I think was the case with Elvis's mother, but actually sometimes surgeons reaching the entire hand in there and sort of pulling out the clog. There was just some truly astounding approaches to impaction. And again, this is one person saying this. I wasn't able to Priscilla Presley, wanted not even to speak to Dr. Nick about this. So I can't verify that beyond a person saying that while gazing at a megacolon and saying his mother had to manually disimpact him. So this is something I can't fact check that. But
right. It's non-canonical and possibly apocryphal, but so make of it what you want. You know, when we talk about this level of impaction, we're talking about things in some cases, and I think this might have come out, as so to speak, at Elvis Presley's autopsy, stuff that had been in there for like 4 months.
Yeah, exactly. And the longer material, to use a nice euphemism, the longer material sits in there, the drier it gets and the harder it gets. And then, of course, the harder it is to get it out because it's not malleable. You don't get that lovely, what is it they call in the Bristol stool scale, like a sausage or snake, smooth and long. You don't have that. You've got like kind of a rock. And in fact, that's what was discovered at Elvis Presley's autopsy. It gets hard. It's just, you know, not something that's easily going to come out of small opening.
So Mary Roach, Elvis wasn't the first person to be constipated or obstipated, to use the, I think, the extreme term of this, and neither was Martin Luther. Constipation has probably been with us as long as eating and defecating has. What did you learn about the history of treating this? I mean, what did people do about it?
Some kind of incredible things. On the lighter end of it, you had medical gymnastics, which was something wherein there'd be a professional of sorts who would be stroking the colon, just kind of trying to rhythmically, medical gymnastics, to sort of the colon stroke the offending object along. There were also a couple of cadaver studies where the researcher would have a cadaver in the anatomy lab, essentially, and people gathered around watching. And there was one of these people was a believer in just putting a lot of water up there and trying to flush it out. And this description of when the pressure was let off and they opened up the rectum, there was a spout 2 feet high of water sort of coming out of the cadaver. That's an image that's kind of hard to get out of your mind. You could also kind of address it from the other end. With live patients, having people, sometimes they have patients swallow lead shot or actually mercury and then roll the patient around to try to use these bits of metal to break up the obstruction. In one case, 7 pounds of metal. Not a good thing to do because it would all tend to gather in one spot and then like weigh down the segment of the colon and make things worse. My favorite by far was the physician, Thomas Sydenham. And I couldn't figure out why this was something that he recommended for an impacted bowel, but he said to have a live kitten kept continually lying on the naked belly for 2 or 3 days, a live kitten. And I don't know if that was to warm things up, to kind of make you feel happier and hope that it would clear up on its own, or maybe the kitten was doing some sort of kneading, you know how kittens sort of knead?
Yeah,
I don't know if that was it. There was no explanation. It was just something that he recommended.
It's certainly the nicest one. It's the most, you know, I mean, it certainly beats the one where they pass the galvanic current.
The galvanic current was, there's a period of time when electricity was like, oh, let's try that for everything.
Exactly.
And there was someone in the audience, and the researcher was presenting his paper. This is the 1800s at some point. I think I'd have to look up the date. But someone raised, you know, someone in the audience in the amphitheater said, well, how effective was it? And the guy goes, effective? I could hardly get out of the way in time. Just, again, an image that's hard to erase from your mind.
Yeah, and then there's nothing blunter, I suppose, than making somebody swallow lead shot to knock it out of down there. So, but maybe the most primitive is just finding a big, tall, powerful, muscular orderly and just kind of slinging the person over that orderly's shoulder.
Yeah, that was another approach. Just swing him over the shoulder, kind of jostle him around. Horseback riding, also a nice one. And I noted that Elvis Presley at Graceland, there's a stable that he enjoyed horseback riding. I have no way of knowing that was something that he did in order to help with his constipation. But anyway, horseback riding was also suggested as a way to kind of jostle things around and hopefully break them up.
Right. Actually, one of the things that is, I think, is dealt with in a footnote, but that there's an expression that's, I will now euphemize, that you can knock the poop out of somebody. And you actually did, I think, find a gastroenterologist who'd been a former football player who actually claimed that that had happened to him at least once in his life, right?
Yes. It was some kind of a tackle that literally did knock that out of him.
Right. The Mean Joe Green had actually tackled him so hard that he had to go change his underwear in the locker room. So, all right, Mary Roach, author of many things. Grunt would have been a more appropriate title, as I said, but Stiff is yet another one of it. I think you were on for that book. But Mary Roach, in this case, author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
Constipation. The poop won't leave my butt. It's just stuck up there. It's a terrible sensation, constipation.